Today, we're going to look at the idea of defining missions and the missionary task. And last night, we looked at sort of the idea of a biblical philosophy of missions and what that might look like. And today, so that was very broad. Today, we're going a little bit more narrow, and we're thinking specifically about this idea of what exactly do we mean when we say missions. And the starting point for this really is linguistic. So you're aware that the word missions is not a Bible word. Let's think about the actual term, and let's admit to ourselves that the word missions is not a Bible word. So that's why oftentimes people will define missions any way they want, because it's not really specifically defined in the Bible as a term. But linguistically, grammatically, the word, our English word missionary, really essentially comes from the idea of the Greek word apostello. And you know this word, right? What is apostello? What's the word that it sounds like?
Apostle.
Apostle. And what is an apostle? A sent one. Someone with a commission. Right? So someone who's given a commission on behalf of someone else. So apostello is to be commissioned, or to commission, to send. So that's the idea. And of course, even in the New Testament, in our own Bibles, that Greek word apostello is applied not only to the 12 or to Paul. It is applied at times to Barnabas. It is applied to Timothy. It is applied to various ones who are commissioned or sent out. But they're all essentially doing some kind of ministry that is pushing forward the borders of the Jesus movement, or of the kingdom of God, of the kingdom of Jesus. So Jesus had basically told his disciples to go out with this message of redemption and to keep pressing forward with that message. So he commissions them with that charge, to go out and to win disciples, to make converts, make disciples in all the parts of the world, in all the people groups, among all the geographic nations, however you want to define that, to keep moving forward. So that's where the idea comes from. And of course, for a number of centuries, Latin was the primary translation of the Bible. That's a whole other story. You're probably familiar with some of that. But Latin became essentially the lingua franca, the language of the educated throughout Europe in particular. And so the word apostello from our Greek language was translated as metere, which means the same thing, to commission or to send, in Latin. The noun form of metere is missio. So missio is the idea of to have a mission, to go on mission. So think of the military. The military goes on mission. They have a certain assignment. They're commissioned to do a certain thing. They're given a task, and we call that a mission. So in a very similar sense, I'm not necessarily trying to compare Christian missions to the military, but in a very similar sense, in terms of how we think we are sent out to accomplish a term. And then that becomes, in the anglicized English version, the idea of a mission, or to be a missionary. So what I'm saying to you is, even though there's not a Bible word missionary, it really is the Bible idea of to be a sent one, someone commissioned to move the gospel forward in places where it doesn't yet exist. So how do we, in our common parlance, in our everyday usage, how do we tend to use this word missionary? Well, we use it in two ways. We use it in a broad sense, that is, in sort of an everyday sense. And when we do that, we tend to define every Christian as a missionary. How many have ever heard the idea, every Christian is a missionary? Or, I think it was even Spurgeon who said some version of this, maybe not these exact words, but Spurgeon was one who maybe first said this idea, you're either a missionary or you're a mission field. You've heard that, right? And there's a sense in which that's true. One mission agency, I haven't seen any of these in a long time, unless it's just a very old, you know, somebody's leftover. But there was one of the mission agencies had a sign that you could put over your door that said, you are now entering the mission field. I grew up with one of those signs over our door. You know, you're leaving the house, you are now entering the mission field. There is a sense in which that's valid, right? We should be thinking evangelistically. We should be recognizing that we have a responsibility to evangelize and make disciples. That is not just the realm of someone commissioned by a church, sent to some faraway place. That's all of our business. I would argue that's not the best way to use the term, but I'm not going to argue with people. I never try to take that away. If someone says, you know, I'm a missionary, I don't want to take that away from people. But I don't think that's necessarily the most technical use of the term. So in a sense, every Christian's a missionary. And frankly, you can kind of get that idea from the commission passages. When Jesus tells his disciples, go into all the world and make disciples, or go into all the world and preach the gospel, he's not talking just to those 11 men. It really is, by implication, all of their followers then become responsible for the same message. So yes, every Christian is responsible for the commission passages. And in fact, I would take that further, and I would say it is unfortunate that too often in too many churches, the Great Commission or those other commission passages, maybe Acts 1:8, John 20:24, Luke 24:44-46, those commission passages oftentimes are relegated only to missionary preaching, when really those are for all of us. All of those passages are applicable, at least on some level, to every Christian. So the commission passages, we could say this is the subjective side of missions. It's not very highly defined. It's more about how we feel, how our sense is of what our duty is. So in a subjective sense, yes, everyone is a missionary. And again, I'm not trying to take that away. I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying that's only one way to see this. And I think we use that term when we say every Christian is a missionary. We're using that term probably to mean we all are responsible to evangelize and make disciples. So again, that's not a bad thing. But we're not being specific when we say every Christian's a missionary. We're just saying every Christian has certain responsibilities that are incumbent upon every Christian. All right, so let's think of this more in the vocational sense. I'm not a big fan of the word vocational, again, because that makes it sound like this is something you only do if you get paid. But maybe we could say in a more technical sense, or in the sense of someone who has devoted themselves to this specifically as maybe a calling, that's a vocational sense. There's a specific purpose and objective. So it's not just that every Christian is supposed to be winning the lost. That's true. But you have a specific area, a specific objective. You have a specific people or a specific region that you're attempting to reach in order to advance the kingdom of Christ. And so you have objectives. It's definable. So again, in the sense that every Christian ought to be doing this wherever they go, that's kind of subjective. That's kind of open-ended. I'm one of the early visits to Cuba. I've been to Cuba a bunch of times. One of my very early visits, I was detained. I asked them after 2 hours if I was under arrest, and they said no. And I said, well, then I'm leaving. And they said, oh, no, you're not. And I said, well, now it's semantics, right? So I don't know if I was arrested in Cuba or not, but I was detained for a couple hours, and I was interrogated. And it mostly had to do with being a Christian witness. And they said, you're a missionary. And, you know, so then I got semantic, and I said, well, no, I'm just a Christian. Well, then why are you going and doing all these things? Talking to people about Jesus, giving gospel papers, gospel literature. I said, because I'm a Christian. That's what Christians do. Well, yeah, but you're not from here. I said, yeah, but Christians should do that everywhere they go. Christians here should be doing that. Of course, it's not legal to do that for Christians in Cuba, which is why I came to their attention. But it is true. Every Christian should be doing this wherever you go. But if you go to a specific area for a specific goal with a specific objective, that's more of a typically what we think of vocational missions. And then when you want to know what that looks like, we looked at some of this last night, right? Even in the ministry of Jesus and the Apostle Paul, you don't look just at the commission passages, which are kind of broad and encompassing all believers, but you kind of look at how Paul practiced his ministry. We're going to do that a little bit more here in this hour. Look specifically where Paul goes, how he decides where to go. He seems to target larger cities, cities where there's a lot of commerce, where there's a lot of movement, so that the gospel can be established there, and then the gospel can be carried from there to other places. So to understand that, really, that sense of the practice of missions, it's really good to get a good grasp of what's taking place in terms of movement and planning and strategy in the book of Acts. And then the places, there's a number of places in Paul's epistles, as I mentioned last night, we'll look at more in depth here in a moment, in Romans, where Paul kind of spells things out as to his activity. And this is what I would say, again, is sort of an objective, as compared to a subjective, which is sort of, you know, how I feel about it. Objective is it's definable, it's measurable, it's more specific. One of the things I think that happens, so I'm on the our missions committee at our local church there in Greenville, and I serve on several mission organizations on their board. And one of the things that happens is you'll have someone who is desirous of going out as a missionary, raising support, and so you interview them, whether it's as a local church or with a mission agency, and sometimes you get sort of the warm and fuzzies. And it's kind of like that guy I mentioned last night that wants to go to Bavaria and just have a little handful of people. And sometimes you kind of get this, I just want to go and love people. I just want to go and maybe shepherd people. But it's not very definable. And I really believe we do this in our local church. I've really insisted on doing this in the mission agencies I serve with, is that we ask people to give us, as best as you can, sort of a 10-year plan. What is this going to look like? What specifically are you hoping to accomplish? Now, was it Napoleon who said that no strategy survives first contact? And there's truth in that. So every strategy is going to be subject to change. We know that. But if you don't have any strategy, you don't even know where you're aiming, right? So mission should be objective. It should have strategy. It should have someone thinking through, where are we going with this? I remember once I was visiting some missionaries on behalf of a mission agency in West Africa. And we spent 3 days, I spent 3 days helping them develop a 10-year strategy. And they had said, you know, this is great, we never thought about this. And it helped them reorder their priorities, think about what is the most important thing to do next. And so we said, okay, 10 years from now, where do you want to be? And then let's work that back. Let's figure out, what does that take? And where should you be in 5 years if you're going to be here in 10 years? 10 years is not a magical number, it's just, you got to have something to hang things on. And then if you're going to be here in 5 years, what do you have to do in years 1, 2, 3, and 4? And we spent 3 days really working through it. And I didn't tell them what to do because it's not my field. I don't know the field. They worked through it. And in 4 years, they had completed the strategy and they were able to move to another place. So I think that's a very important aspect of this thing. Oh, I left off the last one. Oftentimes, unfortunately, we use the idea of a vocational missionary in our actual, the way we think of missions, just as someone who's supported. So if I were to ask you, and maybe I could have done this, I didn't. If I were just to say, who is a missionary? That might have been a good exercise. Who is a missionary? And I promise you, at least somewhere, it would come out, it's someone that the church supports to do ministry. Okay, that's not necessarily incorrect, but that's insufficient. Or it's someone who goes far away. But you could be reaching a subculture here in Hendersonville as a missionary that is outside of your cultural confines. So those definitions really are not really that helpful. They get a little bit fuzzy. And the other thing, this actually was the case of the church we attend in Greenville when we first started attending, they put everything under the label missions. So we want to support the Women's Center, the Piedmont Women's Center. That's a great thing. I very much believe that our church should be giving money to help them in their attempt to lower abortion. But I'm not going to call that missions. Is it a good charitable organization? Is it a good, worthy ministry? Yeah, let's do it. That's not missions. They supported a Christian camp. That's not missions. They supported, other ministries. So things are local, and that's all good, but that's not really missions. So just because it's supported doesn't mean it's missions. So you say, now that I've opened that can of worms, so what do you label as? Well, we worked over time to divide our budget and say, these are ministries we support. We're happy to do that. We believe in that. But this is missions over here. And we separated that for clarity so that we can have a better understanding within the congregation of what constitutes missions. All right, so I've already kind of mentioned this, but let's think about this for a minute. This is simple logic. The success of any endeavor is measured by its final outcome. So after today, you're going to go to lunch after this session, What are you going to do this afternoon? This isn't a trick question, but what are you going to do this afternoon? Jordan, what are you going to do this afternoon?
I'm going to have some people over to my house.
Okay, yeah, people over to your house for what reason?
Just
to hang out, okay. Is Ben one of those people?
Yes.
Okay, so I want to ask Ben. Kevin, what are you going to do?
I'm also going to
You have no idea. So it's definitely going to be successful because there's no point in it. I mean, there's no objective. Anybody out? What are you going to do? What are you going to do this afternoon?
Laundry.
You're going to do laundry. Okay, there you go. I've got a bunch of sticks, a bunch of branches fell in my yard from the last big rain and the winds and so forth. And that's maybe one of the things I'll do is go clean up the yard. Anybody else? Yeah.
I was going to ask Jane if she wanted us to come over and help her put together her generator. She has a generator.
Her what?
She has a little generator she can't.
Oh, use. Generator. I thought you said gin rigger, and I thought, what's it? It sounded like a still or something. Wait a minute. Okay. Okay. Anybody else? All right. So, who said you're going to do laundry? Okay. How do you know if he did it? How do you know if it was successful?
When the clothes are clean.
The clothes are clean. It's simple, right? How do I know if when I... My objective is to clean up and say, how do I know whether I've been successful? The sticks are no longer all over the yard. They're in a neat pile somewhere. How does Jordan know whether his hanging out with Ben and other friends has been successful?
They show up.
Yeah, they're there. They hung out. So what I'm saying is, we all do this. We all think this way. I teach class. How do I know whether I've been successful as a teacher? Well, one, they keep paying me. What else? The students learn. They pass. If half the class fails, it probably says a lot about me, right? And then we do evaluations at the end of the semester, and students, you know, tell what they really think, and that's always actually pretty helpful. How does the student know whether he or she has succeeded? You passed. You got a good grade, right? So we think this way, but we don't think this way in missions. We don't. We say, be warmed and filled, go to the field, and as long as you keep loving Jesus and working hard, we're going to keep giving you money perpetually. I don't understand that. Honestly, I don't understand that. So if the president of Bob Jones University is the president, and every year the enrollment goes down and it goes down and it goes down and it goes down and everything's falling apart, you think he's going to stay the president forever? Probably not. If every semester my students write the most horrid evaluations, you know, Vowles is so lame, he's so boring, he's so unfair, you think they're going to keep me as a teacher? No. If there's a funny tax commercial, I forget what it's for, but she comes in to ask the guy to do her taxes, and the guy is kind of a crook and a cheat, and it comes out. You think that guy's going to succeed as an accountant? No. Why not? Because nobody has the idea that you should just get paid for existing, for being. Well, I shouldn't say nobody. There are some people who actually do believe that. Some of them are running for president right now. That's a whole other story. But normally, we don't think of life in those terms. But we do tend to sometimes think of missions that way. And so, for example, in our local church, we tell people, look, we're not promising to support anybody for life. We're not. We're going to evaluate you every time you come home for the field on a regular basis. In other words, not maybe you've had to come home twice because of illness in your family, whatever. But if your cycle is 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever, at the end of that cycle, we're going to evaluate. We're going to decide whether we want to support you again. Now, that sends shivers down the spine of missionaries. And I get that. I understand that. I've been on missionary support at one point in my life. I understand that. But I also think that that's not only good stewardship, but it actually is normal, right? Because you're saying to people, we went through a process where we stopped supporting some missionaries in our local church. And we said, look, you're good people. You do the right thing day by day, but there's no outcome. And after maybe 20 years, there's no outcome. And it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to keep putting our money into that. And there were people that got upset in the congregation, as well as some of the missionaries, saying, but you made a pledge. So if we did, that was a mistake. Our pledge now is we'll support you for the next cycle. We're not going to be arbitrary and cut you off in the middle of your time in the field. But when you come home and you have the opportunity to raise support, you may need to raise some more support. That's maybe getting into the weeds. But my point is, we define success by accomplishment. And what we've said to our missionaries is we are funding outcomes. We're not necessarily going to define the outcomes because we're a long way away. It's not fair for us to say, unless this, and this. There are churches that do that. Unless this, and this happens, we're not going to give any more money. That's not really fair, I don't think. You should be visiting missionaries in the field. You should know them. You should, when they're back with you, you should really get to know them, have a real sense of the struggles and burdens. And again, every strategy is going to require adjustment. It's going to happen. But if it just seems like people are spinning their wheels, I'm not sure that that's a good investment. Okay. So, in order to define a missionary task, we must consider what missionary endeavor will accomplish if it's done successfully. So that's just, I think, applying some basic reasoning, even what I would say is some biblical reasoning, to this idea of missions. So here's the Mark Vowles, maybe a little academic, maybe a little bit wonky, definition of missions. Missions is the purposeful transfer of responsibility for the gospel to people who are not yet bearing, who do not yet bear that responsibility. In other words, there's someone who is in a place, let's just say Yemen. Yemen is a very Islamic country, Sharia law, very much under the influence of Saudi Arabia, but now there's a rebel minority that's under the influence of Iran, and that's why there's a civil war going on there. But very few Christians, probably less than 0.1% of the people are believers. And there are some missionaries in there being very faithful, risking their lives, trying to reach people. But I can't expect the average local Muslim Yemeni to become a pastor or to evangelize because he's not a Christian. So in order for that, for Christianity to move forward in that region, in that place, a missionary, someone from the outside, someone who's not from that area, because there aren't believers in that area, someone from the outside has to come in and purposefully, intentionally win people for Christ, disciple people in the gospel. But with the goal, with the intention that what I want to do is transfer that responsibility so that not only am I evangelizing you and discipling you, but I'm expecting that you are going to evangelize and disciple other Yemenis. And eventually, one of the Yemenis is going to pastor other Yemenis. And maybe long-term, some Yemenis are going to be Bible teachers and provide theological training to establish churches in Yemen. So I'm transferring responsibility. My whole goal in missions is to take what I possess, what I know, and to transfer that. Now, that can happen on a number of levels. It can be, as I said, just pure evangelism and discipleship. Like, that's the starting place. There are no Christians. Nothing's going to happen in terms of Christianity until somebody comes in and introduces Christianity. Are there places like that still in the world? About a third of the world still has literally no access to the gospel. People will be born there and die there and never once hear the name Jesus. About a third of the world's population. That's mostly in the majority Muslim world, majority Hindu world, majority Buddhist world, and in some cases the communist world. And there are people there, and why are there oftentimes not missionaries there? Because it's really hard. Because they will kill you if they catch you, or they'll send you home if they catch you. They will persecute the Christians there, maybe kill the Christians. It's really hard. And that's why, historically, those are the last places that are often still unreached. That is really a whole other discussion. And what does it take, and how do you do that? You're not going to get a missionary visa there, so that's a whole other discussion of what that might look like, and that might be for another day. But again, the goal is to transfer responsibility. So maybe there are Christians, maybe there are believers, but they're not really discipled. I remember after the Soviet Union fell apart in the late 90s, I just started working at Bob Jones, and we got this letter signed by a handful of Russian pastors asking if we could send any Russian speakers to disciple people because there were so many conversions. The gospel was moving so rapidly among the Russians. There weren't yet all that many missionaries. It was Russians reaching Russians, what had been the underground church, reaching other Russians. But there were so many they couldn't keep up with the discipleship. Well, we didn't, myself at least, I sent this out to every mission agency I could think of. But I don't know that I knew anybody who could, like, is ready in Russian to just go. But it was like, you know, if I had students at that time that were Russian speaking and could go spend the summer, I would have push that and even maybe help fund that, because that would have been a great opportunity. So sometimes it's maybe in the next step of the whole process. At the end of whatever missionary work, you should have local, sustainable, indigenous churches that are able to fund their own ministry, expand their own ministry, train people for their own ministry. And along the way of that whole big process, there are going to be points where outsiders can come in and help carry that to the next stage, to help them bear that responsibility. Does that make sense? So missions is always about pushing forward the boundary, transferring responsibility, so that people will take that responsibility themselves. Sometimes what happens is a missionary will go to a field, and he's really good at maybe evangelizing, discipling, but he doesn't transfer the responsibility. He does it himself. And why did, you know why that happens? Because often that's the experience back home. That's how he grew up seeing Christianity. Well, the pastor, we pay him. You know, maybe we have an assistant pastor. We pay him. That's what they're supposed to do. But, I've got a life to live. I've got a job to do. I've got a family to take care of. That's not my job to do ministry, to reach out to people, to evangelize and disciple. That's for him. You grow up and you see that. And I'm meddling here, if you haven't noticed. But what happens is we think our whole church responsibility is to show up. This is my Christian duty. I'm here. I'm in the pew. That's my Christian responsibility. That is very far from the New Testament image. But if that's how we understand Christianity, we take that to the mission field and we think, okay, I have accomplished the goal. I have gathered a group of believers and I'm now serving them, shepherding them, and that's it. Unfortunately, that's not even very good pastoral strategy, frankly. But it's really horrible mission strategy because there's no transfer. There's no ability to see that move forward. And it becomes self-limiting. It becomes a situation where at some point that missionary has to leave for whatever reason and the ministry just has nowhere to go. It's going to fall apart. A friend of mine, a guy I went to school with, a guy that our church supported for actually decades, I asked him, he was visiting our missions committee, and I said, "Brother, you know I love you, but I'm going to ask you a hard question. If the plane crashes on your flight back, after 20 years of ministry, you've got like 20 people, if the plane crashes, what happens with those 20 people?" He said, "Within 2 weeks, the church will dissolve." I said, "Then I don't think we need to keep funding that, honestly." And we aren't. That was hard. It was honestly very hard. It shouldn't be easy. But the point is that we're looking to move the ball forward. We're looking to transfer that responsibility. All right, and there'll be maybe questions about that later. So what exactly is the missionary task? Missions is not just about reaching people for Christ. Now, it is about that. So you show me a missionary who is not reaching people for Christ, and I'll scratch my head and say, in what sense is that a missionary, right? So I know some mission personnel, their whole missionary role is to be a pilot. They ferry people from one part of the country, but they're also still reaching people for Christ because they're Christians. That's what Christians do. And they're very active in their own local church on the field, and yet they're also a missionary pilot. That's their primary role. So everybody's supposed to be reaching people for Christ, but it's not only that. It's not just to give the gospel. Missions is about getting the local people to reach their own people for Christ. That's missions. Missions is I'm transferring that responsibility, not just to reach their own people, but to do all the aspects of ministry, right? So it's all about transferring that responsibility. We can put it this way. A missionary is a starter. A missionary is an initiator. His whole role is to start something. Maybe evangelism, if there's no saved people, it has to be evangelism. It may be education. Maybe you have a group of local churches, but there's no real solid theological training, which leads maybe to some heresies and to some confusion. And so maybe someone can come in and actually provide some solid theological training. There are numbers of ministries that do that kind of thing, some more in a permanent sense, some in a modular sense where they come in for a couple of weeks and provide training. All that. What are they doing? They're helping transfer responsibility to the local people. The one who continues or completes the task is a local convert. We have to think that way. And we have to measure success that way. To what extent are the local people, the local believers, becoming responsible for ministry? All right, so let me ask you this question. Let's say this afternoon, after lunch, you go home, whatever you're doing, laundry, hanging out, picking up sticks in the yard, whatever it is you're doing, Babu shows up. Babu comes walking up to your door, knocks on the door, you open the door, and what do? Right? Like,
slam.
What? Yeah, that's your first impulse. Oops, I'm in a twilight zone. Nope, not going to happen. Okay, but let's say Babu says, "Good morning, Sahib. I'm very happy to find you at home." And he says, "I've come to talk to you about spiritual things." And you're like, "Yeah, no." Right? That's your impulse. I'm there. That's my impulse. But let's say for whatever reason you're being friendly and maybe you're curious. You say, "Okay, Babu, what's the deal?" He says, "I've come here to live in your neighborhood to bring the good news of Jesus Christ. He died on the cross for our sins." So Babu says, "I've come to bring you good news of Jesus Christ and his death on the cross and his resurrection." And you're like, "Now what are you thinking?" Yeah, this is a cult, right? I mean, that's what I'd be thinking. This is not Bible Christianity. But you let him talk, and the more he talks, you realize this guy is a genuine, bona fide Christian. He is just as much a believer in Jesus Christ as you are. And you are delighted, and now your kind of disposition changes, and maybe you give him a handshake or a hug, and you say, "Babu, I'm a Christian. I'm your brother in Christ," or sister in Christ, as the case may be. And so you're talking, you know, it's all good, and you're asking questions. At some point, you're going to ask a very important question. What question do you want to ask Babu? I'm sorry? Yeah, why are you here? Like, why did you come to Hendersonville, North Carolina, to bring the gospel? And that's a valid question, right? Because whose responsibility is it? So let's say your neighbor is not a Christian. You say, "You know, Babu, I'm a Christian. My family, we're Christians. We go to church. We're solid followers of Jesus Christ. But my neighbor, I saw him drinking beer." I'm being facetious. Or I heard him one time yell at somebody. He's clearly not a believer. You need to go over and you need to reach him. What's the, maybe Babu can go over and reach him, I don't know. But there's a fallacy with that. What's the fallacy? Whose responsibility is it to reach your neighbor? Is it Babu coming from the other side of the world, or is it somebody else's? Yeah, it's your responsibility, right? Now, there are other problems here. And that is, Babu, he's got an accent. That's self-limiting. He's dressed like a swami. So that probably wouldn't be the case if he was actually a Christian. But for sake of illustration, he's not going to get a lot of traction in your neighborhood dressed like a swami, right? Somebody's going to call the cops. So you may want to advise Babu, you might want to consider, wearing, a Tar Heel shirt or what, Duke shirt or whatever the local preference is. You might want to consider something different, right? And let's work on that accent or whatever. But at the end of the day, it is the responsibility of believers in Hendersonville to reach the non-believers in Hendersonville, right? So why do we send missionaries? I'm sorry?
To start something.
Yeah, because for whatever reason, it's not happening. And ostensibly, it can't happen until someone from the outside comes in and helps it get started. That's the whole point of missions. So, and by the way, when you go, or if you go as a missionary, say to, let's assume he's from India. I don't know if that's, that may not be a fair assumption, but it could be by the picture. Yeah, let's say you go there. You know how they're going to look at you? The same way you look at Babu, which that's a whole other discussion. And how do you work through that cross-culturally? Okay, so let's take that to the next step. How many of you are familiar with Patch the Pirate, the audio, the CDs? Okay, so the very first one, if I'm not mistaken, the very first Patch the Pirate audio, back then it was cassette tapes, right, was Patch the Pirate goes to the jungle. The jungle was the land of Afraidica. And you have all of these, like, character songs. How many of you have ever heard that? Yeah? So this came out at the time our family was doing missionary deputation. So we're, you know, packed in the car. We're driving mile upon mile upon mile. We're, you know, this is what you do when you're on deputation. And you're traveling, and the kids are in the car, and the kids are young, and you want to keep them content. And we didn't have, like, video screens in the car then like you do now, you can have now. And so we're driving, and we would put in the Patch the Pirate cassette. We only had, like, two or three of them, and we didn't have a ton of them. We put them in, and then the kids would, you know, it would keep them happy. They'd hear it over. I had that whole thing memorized. I'd heard that thing so many times. And so it's a weird story about they get shipwrecked in this jungle location, and they meet all these weird people. There's talking hippos, and there's pygmies, and there's, and the only actual other person that's like a regular person is this guy named Banana Man. And he's goofy, right? He's kind of dopey. And at the end of the whole story, all the things that happen and all the character songs, at the end, one of the pirates, it was Pee-wee or one of the younger pirates, says, the boat is fixed. We're going to sail back to, I don't know if it says America or wherever it is that they say they come from. We're going to sail back. And there's one of the young missionary, crewmen, who says, I'm going to stay here. Like, well, why are you going to stay here? Because someone has to replace Mr. Missionary. I didn't mention Mr. Missionary. Mr. Missionary is this really old guy who's been there his entire life. He's the only one, and he's old. Right? Remember the story. And so Pee-wee's going to stay. He's going to serve, and he's going to replace Mr. Missionary. And the music swells, and you're supposed to think, wow! And at that point, I'd always eject the tape. It's like, no. And I'd try to, you know, have this discussion with my kids. That's not how missions works, kids. It's like, Dad, just keep playing the tape. We want to hear the tape. But that's not how it's supposed to work. You know, if we're honest, and this is no slam on Ron Hamilton. Ron Hamilton's not a missiologist, and I'm not a musician, okay? No slam on Ron Hamilton. But that's not how missions is supposed to work. Something went wrong. Why is it that in order to have ministry continue in Afraidica, someone young has to come and replace someone old? Something's broken. So you say, so who is supposed to take Mr. Missionary's place? The only conclusion possible is Banana Man. You say, Banana Man is really, really weird. Right, have you heard all the other characters in that tape? They're all really weird, so he's the perfect candidate, right? So Banana Man, he could be, and apparently, you know, it sounds like in the story, if I remember correctly, he is a believer, and so let's get Banana Man. And Banana Man becomes a native pastor in Afraidica. All right. So let's go back and think about those passages that we looked at. I mentioned last night in Romans but we didn't look at it. Let's think very specifically about what Paul says. And by way of introduction, let me give what I think is the foundation or the purpose for the book of Romans. Not everybody agrees with this, so if you don't agree, that's fine, but this is what I think is happening. Paul has been commissioned by Christ on the road to Damascus. He has actively made disciples and planted churches. He has had three definable missionary journeys found in the book of Acts, and he is winding that ministry down. He has stated several times that he plans to go to Rome. He wants to go to Rome. That's his goal. Now, Paul lives, he's from Tarsus, but he grew up in Jerusalem. His home church essentially is Antioch. That's the church that sent him out. When he goes home from his missionary journeys, he goes to Antioch and then often down to Jerusalem as well. But he realizes that if he's going to go to Rome, in that world system, in that economy, with the travel conditions as they were, it's not going to make a lot of sense to go back and forth to Antioch. So actually, he says at one point he wants to go all the way to Spain. So Spain, at that point in time, represents the westernmost reach of the Roman Empire. That's as far as the Roman Empire goes at that point in time. And then, of course, basically, Palestine is more or less the westernmost part of the Roman Empire at that time. And so Paul is thinking, if I'm going to go all the way to Spain, I need someplace else to kind of make my base. I think that's the whole point of the book of Romans. Paul writes this very detailed doctrinal treatise to the Romans, people who are already believers, people who he commends for their faith, and he's basically saying, this is the true gospel, and I want us to be in agreement because, as we'll see, if you look in chapter 15, he wants to come to Rome, and he wants that to be his home base. He says in chapter 15, I want you basically to commend me on my way, or in other words, meaning I want you to fund me. I want you to become my support base. I think that's what's happening. And so the whole book of Romans is laying out Paul's understanding of the gospel, of theology, of justification, sanctification, and all the rest, so that he can go there and he can become sort of their guy. He joins that team, the home team there. So let's look specifically at the verse and bring all this together. Romans 15, 18 through 21. Paul says, after talking about his goals for the future, he says, I will not venture to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me to bring the Gentiles to obedience by word and deed, by the power of signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God, so that from Jerusalem and all the way around to Illyricum, I have fulfilled the ministry of the gospel of Christ. And thus I make it my ambition to preach the gospel, not where Christ has already been named, lest I build on someone else's foundation, but as it is written, those who have never been told of him will see, and those who have never heard will understand. So Paul, as he's laying this out, he makes this incredible statement. By God's grace, by God's power, he has done what Jesus gave him to do. He has preached the gospel to the Gentiles. And he says in the middle of that statement, I have done this from Jerusalem all the way to Illyricum. Anybody know what modern day Illyricum is? Or where Illyricum is? We don't call it Illyricum anymore. It's essentially Albania. Now, Acts doesn't record specifically any ministry of Paul in Albania, but it comes pretty close from what's mentioned in the journeys. And apparently at some point, he pushed up into what was then Illyricum. Illyricum would have spoken Latin, and Paul wants to go to Rome where they spoke Latin. So maybe he was testing the waters. That's speculation. But maybe he was kind of testing his Latin. That's, again, pure speculation. But he states here that he went to Illyricum. So if you took a map of the ancient Roman Empire and you draw a line exactly down the center, basically right in the center is Rome, which is what you would expect because it is the Roman Empire, the center of the world from their perspective. So what Paul is saying is that from Jerusalem, the farthest west, the westernmost part of the empire, up to Illyricum, which is right near Rome, he has fulfilled the gospel. Paul says, I've done what I was commissioned to do in this entire half of the Roman Empire. Now think about the magnitude of that claim. Did Paul go to every major city in the entire western half of the Roman Empire? In a space of about 10 years, by the way. Did Paul do that? No. Did Paul preach the gospel to every living resident in the western half of the Roman Empire? Not even close. So in what sense can Paul say that he has fulfilled the ministry that he was given in that entire geographic region? How is that even possible to make such a claim? It's possible because Paul's job was to start things. Paul's job was to initiate ministry through evangelism, discipleship, resulting in church planting. And he knew that there were enough churches. There were maybe a dozen, 20 churches, or maybe about a dozen mentioned specifically in the book of Acts. We know of others that grew out of those churches. We know that Paul apparently was planting churches even before the first missionary journey in the area of Tarsus where he was from. All of that, you take all that, so you're talking 20, maybe 25 churches that Paul had some relationship to. No doubt there were others who were planting churches as well. But Paul says, I have established enough, maybe you want to call this beachheads, going back to the military terminology, I've established enough stations so that the gospel can now saturate the region. Think back to that last slide last night. Missions is pushing the boundary forward. Ministry is saturating the region with the gospel through the local church. Paul says there are enough local churches. Now it's time for saturation. My role, the missionary role, I'm going to press forward. And he wants to go into the eastern half of the empire, starting with Rome and moving out towards, all the way towards Spain. Now, that doesn't happen the way Paul envisions it. Paul's arrested at the end of his third missionary journey in Jerusalem. That leads to a series of imprisonments, first in Caesarea, and eventually he's sent on to Rome. Depending on who you read in ancient history, Paul was either executed there at that point in Rome by Nero, or he was released by Nero, went to Spain. Eusebius, early church historian, claims that Paul was released, went to Spain. Later, he is rearrested and he's executed by Nero. But certainly, he didn't fulfill all of his expectations of ministering in the eastern part of the empire like he did in the west, however you understand history. Paul goes on in that same passage to make this statement a few verses later. This is the reason I've so often been hindered from coming to you in Rome. But now, look at this. Now, since I no longer have any room to work in these regions, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain and to be helped on my journey there by you. In other words, I need some money once I've enjoyed your company for a while. Paul makes a statement, I don't have anything left to do in these regions. Really? That's a big region, Paul. No, Paul says, no, I did what I was supposed to do. I think Paul is giving us a very clear understanding of a New Testament mission strategy. You go, you start things, you get the local people to do the ministry. That doesn't mean you abandon them. It doesn't mean you go there for, you know, a couple years and then you forget about them. No, Paul wrote them letters. In fact, if those churches didn't have problems, we wouldn't have half the New Testament, right? All of those letters that Paul writes are crisis letters, answering some crisis, except for maybe Romans. He's answering some problem. And then he goes back and visits. He's consistent in going back and sort of strengthening the disciples. He's not abandoning them. And I'm not saying that a missionary can't go back. And neither am I putting a timeline, right? Paul spoke the local language, the lingua franca. Greek was the main language, at least in the western half of the empire. Paul, the cultures were different, but they were not so radically different. It's not like U.S. versus China. So Paul could more readily adapt. Paul had probably a certain social status. He was a Roman citizen. He had a lot of things going for him that enabled him to move more quickly, more freely than many missionaries today. So I'm not saying it has to be a three-year thing or even a 10-year. It might even be a lifetime thing, as long as it's moving forward, as long as at some point the local believers are able to continue the ministry. But here's what I've seen in my experience, and you've seen this too, where I know a case in Latin America where a missionary went there in the 60s, spent his life there. When it came time to retire, either because of age or health, that mission board sent another missionary. He spent like 10 or 20 years there. When he had to leave for some reason, they sent another missionary. And that was a series of American missionaries year after year after, for literally for 40 years. It just doesn't make any sense. Eventually, one of the missionaries they sent didn't want to be there anymore. And the only way he could find to leave was to get a local to take over. And he found this guy in the church that was like itching, just chomping at the bit to become a pastor. And he had some theological training, and it worked out. And that church grew afterwards. Anyway, there are lots of stories like that. But the point is, that's how Paul did ministry. So let me kind of start winding down with this idea. Here's a very, very simple missions philosophy. If you say, Vals, what is your missions philosophy? It's really simple. Here it goes. Jesus promised that he would build his church. That's an absolute statement. Doesn't matter what you or I do, Jesus is going to build his church. In fact, hell itself is not going to stop Jesus from building his church. Do you realize what's happening in Iran right now? You know what's happening in Iran politically. You know what's happening in Iran spiritually? There are so many people coming to faith in Iran right now that it's a threat to the government. Tens of thousands of converts to Christianity. You don't hear about that on the evening news, but it's happening. And it's not happening by Americans. But Jesus is building his church. It doesn't look like us. It doesn't necessarily practice exactly like us, but Jesus is building his church. Jesus is going to do that. He is going to do that. One way or the other, he's going to build his church. After all the missionaries were kicked out of China in 1949 under Mao, kicked out finally like in 1951, there were about 750,000 Christians in China, registered, known Christians, about 750,000 Christians in China. You know how many Christians are in China today? The government will concede there are 60 million. Most people who look at the situation say there are at least 100 million, maybe 200 million Christians. Why? Because Christ is going to build his church. So that's part one. Part two is Jesus' command to us was go make disciples. You know what we do? We go out and we want to build a church. Missionaries go to the field, I'm going to build a church. No, your job is to make disciples. Like Jesus built his church. That doesn't mean you don't give guidance and you don't shape and you don't teach theology and you don't teach ecclesiology. I'm not saying that. But so many times the focus is on how do I grow this institution and establish the institution. But Jesus said, I'm going to do that. You make disciples, I'll build the church. That's a very, very simple. That actually works for the local church as well. But I think that is a basic missions philosophy. So I'm going to end with this, talking about making disciples. I've used this illustration many times. Maybe you've heard it before. Well, let's just think about the power of discipleship. Because the fabric, as I said last night, the fabric of all ministry, and especially missionary ministry, is making disciples. So let's think about this in terms of Chinese missionary math. How many people live in China right now? Lots. Anybody want to take a guess?
200 million.
One is low and one is high. Actually, the most recent count is probably 1.5 billion. But I did the slides before that very most recent count, so I've got it down as 1.4 billion. So let's say the current population of China, by the way, how many people live in the United States? About 370 million. So we're in the 0.4 there. We fit in within the 0.4. So there are a billion more people in China than there are in the U.S. That again, has all kinds of ramifications, politically and economically, but that's not why we're here. The current population in China is approximately 1.4 billion. So let's say we could freeze that. Let's say we could just stop. We could put it in a time zone, and we could just stop. Nobody's being born. Nobody's dying. It's 1.4 billion. That's static. If you could do that, how long would it take to reach the entire population, every person in China, to evangelize the entire population of China if you have one missionary, one very gifted, one very capable missionary who goes to China, and he could win 3,000 souls for Christ every single day of the year? So this guy, who's extraordinary, his Chinese is better than a Chinese person. He goes to China, he's a missionary. And he goes out to Tiananmen Square. How many of you have been to China? Tiananmen Square is massive, huge. You could fit a million people in Tiananmen Square. It's just massive. But let's just go out and say he just stands out there. Maybe he's got a microphone. Maybe he's got a podium. I don't know. He suddenly just preaches the gospel. And it's like the day of Pentecost. And 3,000 people get saved. That would be awesome. Let's see, he goes back the next day and he does it again. And the next day, and he does it again. And every day, 7 days a week, he goes out to Tiananmen Square and he preaches the gospel, and 3,000 people get saved. By the end of 1 week, everybody in China would know about this. By the end of 2 weeks, everybody in the world would know about this. By the end of the month, every church in America would be trying to support the guy. Right? He's my guy. You know, he's the guy. And we'd be saying, forget you, I'm not going to give you any more support. That guy wins 3,000 people a day. He would be on the cover of every magazine. Even if you hate the gospel, you'd have to put him on the cover of your magazine, because this is an unprecedented phenomenon. So at the end of a year, 3,000 people a day, how many people do you have? A little over a million people, right? And so this is happening. If you have a million people a year, 3,000 people a day, every single day, how long does it take? How long does it take to reach the entire population of China at that rate? 1.4 billion people. 1,279 years. Because that's a huge population. All right, let's change the scenario. Let's say we have the same situation. We freeze the population. We send one missionary. He's not quite so gifted. He's not quite so, you know, charismatic. He's not so personable. He doesn't have the power. So he goes, and rather than preaching and winning 3,000 people a day, he wins one person a year. He goes and he wins that person, but he disciples that person. He pours everything about himself, every bit of gospel responsibility he has, he pours it into that other person. And so he is going to make a disciple. At the starting point, you have one person. At the end of 1 year, how many do you have? Two. And let's say both these missionaries are existing side by side. Missionary A, 3,000 a day. Missionary B, who are you going to support? You're going to say, Missionary B, you need to come home. You're a loser. I mean, that's honestly, that's how we would think. But Missionary B, he just presses on. So he's made one convert and one disciple, and he's poured himself into that person, and that person's going to go out in the next year, and he's going to do the same thing. The missionary's going to do the same thing. So at the end of 2 years, how many do you have?
Four.
And they keep doing the same thing. At the end of 3 years, how many do you have? No, you have eight, because each one is winning one. At the end of 4 years, you have 16, then 32, then 64, then 128. How long does it take to reach the entire population of China at this rate? 27 years. And you can reach the entire population of the planet in 32 years. Do you realize that since the time Jesus gave the Great Commission, said, go into all the world, or go to all the nations and make disciples, do you realize that in every single generation since the time of Jesus, it has been possible to reach the entire population of the world? We just don't do it. And I realize there are all kinds of reasons that doesn't happen. There are all kinds of barriers that are happening. I'm not being simplistic. But we could, each of us, make one disciple. One. This year. And if a missionary is doing that faithfully and consistently, and he's multiplying that way, and the church is being built on disciples who are making disciples, wow, what a different world it would be. So let's wrap this up, and then I'll take any questions you wish. So implications. What does all this mean? Well, first of all, the goal of missions is not to see how many missionaries you can send, right? I used to go into churches. I don't see this here. I haven't seen this actually in a while. But you go into church, and the goal is to see how many missionaries you can put on your board. Like, we have 50. Oh, we have 150. Yeah, that's kind of not really all that useful. But there was a time when that was kind of popular. It's not, the goal is not to see how many missionaries we can send. The goal is to see how many disciples we can make. And if the missionary you're sending is not effectively making disciples in that culture, why are we sending him? If he's not transferring responsibility, well, why are we paying him? I don't mean to be unkind. Those are hard questions, but those are realistic questions. If that's what we're doing, if that's the nature, the fabric of ministry, it's got to be happening. Again, lots of barriers. Sometimes it takes years to learn the language. Sometimes it takes years to gain confidence in local people. Adoniram Judson, 12 years in Burma before his first convert. William Carey, 10 years in India before his first convert. And that same kind of scenario repeats today. I know people that have been in some fields for 10 years. They don't have a single convert. It happens still today. So I'm not putting timelines on things, but I am saying if it's not moving towards that goal, then it's not really effective. Secondly, lots of mission strategies out there. There's short-term missions. There's tent-making missions. There's the traditional career missions. There is marketplace missions. There's all kinds of things that are all valid. They all have a place. How do we evaluate that? Sometimes people will support a national pastor, a national missionary directly, and there's opportunities for that abound. How do we know whether this is effective? How do we know whether this is the right strategy? I think you evaluate it based on how it's producing disciples. You go back to that simple standard. How do I know if this is working? By the outcome, by how many people are coming to be able to repeat the process on their own. And then thirdly, just like children grow up, groups of Christians grow up. So what I'm saying is, not every place that we could send missionaries is a pioneer field. Some places, they need something more than just evangelism. One of the things that honestly kind of, it breaks my heart and it gets under my skin at the same time, is when people set up some kind of a missions franchise. My friend Tim Kazee at Frontline Missions, this is his term, missionary franchising. So here's my illustration. The only time I went to Brazil, I visited a number of missionaries in Brazil. One of them, I had read his prayer letter for 10 years before visiting. And in every single prayer letter, missionary newsletter, this guy would close the prayer letter the same way. He would say, "We are the only Bible-believing, gospel-preaching, independent, Baptist, premillennial, fundamental." And he had a string of 12 adjectives, Baptist church in this entire region and for 100 miles in any direction. And then I get to the field and I visit him. A great guy. He's successfully pastoring a church in the field. Got a lot of good ministry kind of things going on. But as I'm visiting the city, I said, "Brother, what about that church over there?" "Oh, yeah, they're good people. They're not Baptist, but they're good people." I said, "Okay. Do they preach the gospel?" "Oh, yeah." Are they charismatic? "No." Are they theologically sound?" "Yeah." "Okay, what about that church?" And it was all, literally, that city at least, it was almost like Greenville. There's a church everywhere you look. A Protestant church everywhere you look. And I said, "Brother, I'm just really confused. How is it that you sign your prayer letters, you sign off saying we're the only church for 100 miles in any direction?" He said, "Oh, we're the only," and he goes through the 12 adjectives. I said, "What happens if you take away this adjective?" "Well, then it's maybe 50 miles." "So what if you take away this adjective?" I said, "So if you take away about 4 adjectives, we're the only church on this corner." I said, "I have a problem with that." Now, again, I'm not saying we don't represent what we actually believe on the field. Of course we do. But our goal is not to franchise our particular narrow stripe. Our goal is to establish Christians, give people hope of heaven, and the opportunity to glorify God forever. That's our goal. And so so we evaluate missions based on what really is needed on that field. And we evaluate that based on what the local people are telling us. If there are no Christians, then the need is go make disciples. You want to go to missionaries at Yemen? Go. However you get there, go. Because there's so much need, so much opportunity. But not every place in the world is the same. So if you say you want to go to any country I name is going to cause somebody heartburn. So let's just say Mexico. You're going to go to Mexico and plant a church. If it's just because they don't have your exact version of church with your exact 12 adjectives, don't go. But if you're going because there's a need there that's not being met and you can help move the ball of the gospel forward, go. And when you've accomplished that, go somewhere else and do the same thing. But the goal is that we evaluate the activity based on what the actual need is. Not just because I really want to be a pastor in that city. That's not a good missionary goal. Okay, I think I better stop because the more I talk, I'm going to get myself in trouble. So what questions or comments? Something I can clarify, amplify, modify, deny I ever said.
Yeah. What would be your advice for younger missionaries training to go help seasoned missionaries who probably were retiring very
soon? Well, two things. First of all, you have to be a learner before you can be a teacher. And even though you may, depending on the activity and so forth, you may, almost inevitably, a younger person in any endeavor, right? Maybe you're a carpenter. The young carpenter thinks he knows more than the old carpenter. It's just human nature. So almost in any endeavor, there's potential for conflict. But even if you have a different perspective, even if the younger missionary has a different perspective, different strategy, he would be very wise to be respectful and to learn from the older missionary, certainly in terms of integration in the culture, understanding socially the people, understanding what kinds of things they respond to, all those kind of things you can learn from anybody who spent time in the field. I did a field survey one time with two missionaries, a young couple, wanting to go to West Africa. They wanted to go to Mauritania, which is really tough. It's Sharia law, and it never worked out for them. But so we were looking at Senegal, thinking maybe from Senegal they could move north into Mauritania. Anyway, so we went with them, and we planned out this 10-day visit. And they said, "What are we going to do?" I said, "I want you to scour the web, the internet, write to different mission organizations." And I said, "I want to talk to anybody who's been here any length of time." They said, "You mean all the fundamentalists?" I said, "I mean everybody, Catholic, Protestant, Mormon, if they know the people, if as an outsider they've learned the people, I want to talk to them. I want you to understand. I want you to learn from them." So that's step one. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean you fellowship with them and co-labor with them, but there's something to be learned. One of the big challenges, I've done some writing and some speaking with some mission organizations about the millennial generation and how they tend to approach missions in particular. It's different because they're a different generation. Now, what I teach is the Generation Z, and I'm still trying to figure that out. But there are generational differences. That's inevitable. The problem that comes is that most of the people in the field are boomers or Generation X, and they're not ready for millennials. And millennials are not always all that good at integrating. They tend to feel like they know so much they can take over. So I've worked with a couple of mission agencies that are giving training on both ends, saying, "Okay, we want you to be able to work together." Is that answering your question, or is there something more specific involved there?
You use the term mission agency.
Yeah.
Can you put a little more color on that? What is a mission agency?
Well, so agencies arose as the result of what we sometimes think of as the modern age of missions, which often is accredited as starting with William Carey. That is not when the first Protestant missionaries went out. Some of the reformers sent missionaries. Calvin sent missionaries. Zwingli sent some missionaries. So there was missionary activity prior to William Carey, even coming some from England. But in order to financially sustain those people, different organizations were started, typically, at least at first, within denominations in order to fund the missionaries. That was often by subscription, which is essentially the same as, you know, we give a pledge or a promise. But these agencies would ask people to subscribe to give money. Anyway, or the churches to subscribe to give money. And in some ways, some of the denominations still function that way. So, for example, the Southern Baptist Convention, they have the cooperative program. The churches are not obliged, but they're asked to contribute to that program. And then the Southern Baptist Convention, their missionary branch, hires missionaries who are paid as employees of the missionary branch of the International Mission Board. And that's funded through subscriptions by local churches. So some of that still functions. Hudson Taylor came along in the late 1800s, and he started what is commonly known as the Faith Missions Movement. And so basically what Hudson Taylor did was he recruited missionaries, and he went out to individual churches and said, I want you to pledge support for these missionaries. Then they would pool the money, and he would distribute it evenly. So sometimes they got, every missionary got the same amount. Sometimes they got more, sometimes they got less. So the idea of the Faith Missions Pledge is still typically how most of our kinds of churches fund missionaries. We make pledges individually as churches. Those pledges are sort of pooled and collected and administrated typically by a missionary organization, missions agency. Those agencies, although it's not typically, there is at least a couple agencies that you might be familiar with that still operate on the pool the money and distribute it evenly principle. But that's not very common anymore. Typically, it's whatever you've pledged, they pass that along directly to the missionary. And so once he has so much pledged, it's dependent on the group of local churches that are supporting him, or maybe some individuals, to keep giving that every month. What the mission agency does is it has its own identity that the missionary associates with that identity. So let's say Baptism and Missions or Faith Independent Baptist or Faith Independent Mission. I don't know what others you're familiar with, Gospel Fellowship Association Missions. So they have basically a doctrinal position, a ministry position, and so missionaries would identify with that particular maybe vision or their particular approach and strategy. And the agency serves as sort of a way to serve the church. It essentially acts as a mediator. So rather than, if you have a lot of different supporters, the average missionary probably is 25 to 40. That varies depending on the missionary, people that are supporting or church that are supporting. And so the agency works as sort of in between that group of supporters and the missionary and make sure that the funds get channeled. And then if there are problems on the field, they can help and mediate. They also have, because they have experience with missionaries in different fields for often many years, they often have the ability to provide some training and counsel. And there's all different levels of that and different forms of that, which is why people who are looking at missions, who are considering going through an agency, should really evaluate the fit and the long-term scenario. Some local churches do that work themselves. They act as the agency. There's nothing wrong with that. Certainly, a mission agency as an entity is not a New Testament entity, but neither are youth groups and Sunday schools, so it's not necessarily bad. It's a functional thing, not necessarily a Bible thing. And so the difficulty when a local church takes on this responsibility itself and serves as the mission organization for this mission, or as the sole sort of identity for that missionary, is it may work really well until there's a problem, until there's a crisis. So just as an example, right now I serve on the board of directors for Biblical Ministries Worldwide, which is based in Atlanta. They have about 600 missionaries, more or less, and I forget how many countries, but a number of countries. They have a handful of personnel in mainland China. The organization decided that it was in the interest of their missionaries to leave China if they can. Well, those missionaries, they're not sitting on, you know, say you have a family of four or five, you're looking at a couple thousand, $3,000, maybe more of airfare. Not like sitting there with that money in the bank, just waiting to see when they can spend it. Like no more than you and I are, right? So the mission agency just put up that money. They have an emergency fund collected from the missionaries themselves, collected from other missionaries. It goes into an overhead. And so when a crisis comes, they can move. And they were able, the one missionary family chose to stay in the field. That's their, it wasn't mandatory. It was voluntary, but the others came back. Another situation, I know another agency, a family, they were in Papua New Guinea. Some of you may know this story. They were in a pickup truck. The pickup truck went over a cliff. The wife broke her back, needed to be air vac'd from Papua New Guinea to Australia, like now. And so the only people running a helicopter service in Papua New Guinea was an organization out of Switzerland. And they said, we'll do this. We need $150,000 up front. Is your church going to put up $150,000 up front? Probably not. They had that girl and that woman in Australia getting medical attention. She's fine now. She's actually living here in Greenville now, or down in Greenville, doing quite well medically. But and all that money was eventually recovered by the insurance. Insurance paid every penny of it, but they wanted cash in hand. And the agency said, fine, here's the money, do it. And within 24 hours, she was in Australia. So that's, I'm not, my goal is not to defend mission agencies. It's to, I think there are pros and cons. And a lot of it depends on the individual. So, did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I appreciate your philosophy last night and what you've done today. This is, really enjoyed this. And I appreciate you that sometimes missionaries go to an area that the ground is firm and it needs to be turned before the seed can
sure.
take hold. And you brought up Hudson and Burma and Kerry in India. However, from a local body standpoint, let's say Hudson had a supporting church, and they sent somebody to evaluate his work at the 8-year mark.
Yeah.
How do we do that when it's, by 8 years, really, there's no disciples?
I really do think a big part of that is it has to be relational. So, for example, at our church in Greenville, I'll be careful how I say this, when we decided we were going to make some shifts, some changes in our missions approach, we had 39 entities, mission partners we called them. About 8 or 9 of those were local ministries, as I said. We still support most of those, but we don't call that mission. So that brings it down to say, let's just say 30. So out of those 30, we went through and we evaluated who do we really want to continue supporting. And part of the reason for that was not just philosophical, as I said. We felt like we couldn't really, as a congregation, serve 30 entities. There's just not enough bandwidth to really, really know them. Our goal is to really know our people. And really, ideally, to be able to support them so substantially. I really do think it's better to support one or two people really substantially than 30 at maybe a couple $100 a month. Because that way, you're so invested in those few people that that's where you're going with your mission trips. When those people come home, they're part of your church. They don't have to go report to 30 different churches. They have you and maybe one or two others, and they're going to stay there. And you're gonna have them really integrated with your people. They're going to know your people. That's who you're reporting on week after week. This is what's happening with our missionaries in this field. And I think if you have that kind of relationship, it's more likely that you will have a good understanding of what's happening. You'll have can that break down? And it can break down in 10 different directions. But I do think there's a lot of value in that. And can people on the field get it wrong? Yeah. And so in our case, at our church, we did a couple of things. First of all, we made an effort to visit all those people on the field. We also, over about a 5-year process, this wasn't a thing we did overnight, over about a 5-year process, we asked for annual updates. We said, you tell us the goals, We're not telling you what the goals are. You tell us your goals. You tell us how it's coming, how it's working. And if there are problems or obstacles or even failures, how does that happen? And then with a handful that we saw really, it really didn't seem like anything much was happening, we let them know that we were going to make a final evaluation. And then we said we're going to reduce your support over 3 years. So it's not ungracious. It wasn't vindictive. I hope it wasn't mean to that, you know. But we felt like that was the right thing to do. And our goal really is to get it down to a very manageable number that we can really support at a lot of money and have that kind of relationship with. That doesn't work for everybody. I gave sort of a presentation of that idea at a fellowship of mission directors, about 20 mission directors from different agencies, all in the same room, and I said, this is what we're trying to do, and they all turned pale. Like, you realize this is going to ruin the way we do missions. And I said, yeah. But I think it's going to be good for the churches, and if enough people do that, it'll all balance out. In the short term, if everybody just decided that today, it would rewrite the way we do missions, and it would be hard for the short term. But what's happening in my estimation, this again is another discussion, what's happening in my estimation is, okay, so the typical approach to missions, you get a missionary visa. What percentage of the world's countries do you think offer missionary visas today? That whole missionary visa thing comes out of the colonialist era, which is far removed, and it gets farther removed with every passing year. What percentage of the world's countries, there are about 200 countries more or less, plus or minus 5. But how many countries, what percentage do you think offer missionary visas? About 40%. So what about the other 60%? You just don't go? That's not an option. We're commanded to go. So you have to come up with alternative means, which means the whole way we think of missions and do missions is shifting, for better or for worse. And I think what we have to realize is that structurally, again, this is a whole much longer discussion, but structurally, the way we do missions in terms of funding and preparation and all of that and support, strategic support and so forth, all of that is extra-biblical. In other words, we don't really know in every detail how Paul funded his ministry. We assume that the church in Antioch gave him some money, but it doesn't say that. We know that some churches helped him on his way, like the church in Philippi sent him offerings, but we don't get the impression that that's enough to live on for the next couple of years. At least I don't get that impression. Paul may have had some of his own money. Paul made tents, sometimes to be an example, but sometimes because he was broke. So our system of deputation and support is a workable system that is about a little less than 200 years old, that has functioned well in this era, but it's extra biblical. It's not unbiblical. It's not against the Bible, but the Bible by no means demands that system. So I've had some people say, you know, the way the Southern Baptists fund a missionary, that's just absolutely evil. You work for the International Mission Board. The churches make pledges to the cooperative program. That is just so unbiblical. I said, it's not. Any more than our system is unbiblical. It's just a different system. And neither one is demanded by the scripture. Okay, long answer to a simple question.
Sense, how do you as a church provide for these visits from, I mean, I'm assuming in our church we would send pastor to go visit, we would pay his airfare because he's...
Right, so we put into our budget years ago, Karen and I have been in Heritage Bible Church for about 8 years, I think it's about 8 years.
Is it more?
10? Okay. My official source is 10 years. And I will go. I'm very sure that's correct. So 10 years, long before we were ever there, they had budgeted this way. I think that's wise. No matter how many mission missionaries who support. I think that's wise. And so our goal, we haven't always, I've been on the missions committee for 6 or 7 years, maybe 8, I guess. Our goal hasn't always been achieved exactly perfectly, but it's been to visit every partner once during their cycle, assuming it's a 4-year cycle, which is not always correct, but say once every 3 years or so, someone from the church. It may be a member of the missions committee, it may be one of the pastors, whatever. But if we were funding significantly fewer, we could do a lot more of that. And there's one mission partner that we're actively interacting with to sort of make him almost like our headliner. This is going to be our poster person. This is the person we're going to rally around. And we're telling him, we'll support you at about 80%. He's already on the field, so he doesn't need that now. But we would be ready to do that. And we want everybody to really know and follow your ministry. And so that means we could send people over there to help them with stuff. Let's say they want to go to a conference and but they can't leave their kids, so they can attend this conference. We could send maybe some people over to keep their kids for a week while they go off to the conference, and we would just bankroll that kind of stuff. So that way, again, it's a very close relationship. Not every church can do that. Not every church is ready for that. I think, though, it's scalable. It's not based on how large the congregation is or how much money the congregation has. It's scalable to your particular situation. And the other thing is, so this, again, this may be opening a whole other discussion, but the churches I grew up with and was around early on, at least, the attitude was, we're going to send our pastor to show the missionaries how to really do the ministry, right? The pastor is the one who knows how to do the ministry. We'll send him there to help the ministry. I really think, after having visited missionaries all around the world, that door swings both ways. I'm not saying the pastors don't have a lot to offer, but oftentimes when a pastor goes to visit the missionaries, he picks up on, here's how you minister to people who don't think like you do, who don't come from the same background you do. And frankly, that's America right now. The world is changing around us so quickly. Anything we can learn about ministering across cultures, across worldviews, that's helpful. So pastors often come back recharged, animated, ready to plug in some of that understanding and perspective into their local environment. That's, I think that's worth every penny a church spends to send their pastor to the field. Anything else?
Amen.
Get a vote from the missionary. Yes, sir.
Well, this is not a question. But
it's snowing.
To support what you're saying, I found through the years that one of the problems is that we have missionaries out there, and it's like reading a fiction book. Where people don't know them.
Yeah, it's hard to understand.
You're not sending.
Right.
It's a terrible
thing. Right. Yeah.
Understand their needs. We don't understand them as real human beings.
Right. The missions coordinator at Bob Jones, we send mission teams. We've been doing that long before. I've been there 20 years, so even well before I was there. In fact, when we were students, more than 20 years ago, many more than 20 years ago, the school was sending mission teams. And so mission teams are wonderful for exposure. Mission teams, you go and you get the panorama of the adventure. Jordan's taking a mission team this summer to Southeast Asia, and I know you already know that. But those students traveling with Jordan will get to see things and experience things and participate in things that they might not otherwise get to participate in. But I also send missions interns. So if you're in the major, before you can graduate, you have to spend at least 8 weeks on the field. And those are not mission teams. My preference is you spend a semester, but that's hard to require. So it requires minimum of 8 weeks so they can do it in the summer. And the goal is, the rule is, You have to spend 8 weeks with a single mission, with a missionary family or a single ministry. And you have to live the ups and downs, the good days and the bad days. You have to see normal life. Because on a mission team, you don't see normal life. You see, wow, you know, and everything's moving so quickly and everything's happening, and then you go home. And that's okay. That's great. But there's something to be said for everyday normal life. And over the years, I've been doing this now for 20 years. This is the 20th summer I've sent interns. Over 20 years, there's been probably 4 or 5 that have come home from the field. They say, no, this is not who I am. And my response is, hallelujah, praise the Lord. We just saved some church thousands of dollars in support for their first term on the field where they realize on the field, this is not for us. And then they come home with guilt and confusion. And so this is a great time to figure that out. Right? Others come home and they're like, oh man, I can't wait to go back. Right? But without exception, they come back and they say, it's not what I thought it was. Without exception. Which is why I want them just to be there in and out, day by day. Because you know what? Missionaries have to do laundry and shopping and fix their cars and all the same things you do. And oftentimes, depending on where they are in the world, it takes a lot longer. You know, shopping here is Walmart. Shopping there may be a 2-day affair. I mean, it's just crazy, depending on where you are. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, appreciate the time. I hope this is helpful, and thank you again for the opportunity.